the Financial Sense Lifetime Planning Program. Here's your host, Jim Poplava.
Well, it is that time of the year. In the next month, students will be graduating from high school, going on to college, and there's a lot of cross currents with college today. There's talk about student loan forgiveness, and then also about the numerous jobs that are out there and what kind of education would get the best job. Joining us on the program is Mark Kantoritz. He's president of Cerebly, a nationally recognized expert on student financial aid. He's also the author of two best-selling books, How to Appeal for More College Financial Aid, and Who Graduates from College, Who Doesn't? Mark, let's begin with the talk about student loan forgiveness. They've been extending this in terms of payments and interest. It began with President Trump. It's continued with Biden. And now they're talking about student loan forgiveness anywhere from $10,000 to $50,000. Fill us in on what's going on here and what's the likelihood of this passing.
So the repayment obligation on most federal student loans has been suspended since March of 2020, and the interest rate has been temporarily set at zero. President Biden just did the sixth extension to this payment pause and interest waiver, and it's set to expire on August 31st of this year. Now, the White House has said that either they will do a seventh extension or they will do some forgiveness before August 31st. I think it's highly likely that they will extend the payment pause and interest waiver until after the election, because it would be political suicide to restart repayment on student loans before the midterm elections. Now, there's a lot of controversy over the prospect of broad student loan forgiveness. There are some people like Senator Warren and Senator Schumer who assert that the president has the authority to forgive student loans with a stroke of a pen through an executive order. On the other hand, Nancy Pelosi in the House has said that the president doesn't have that legal authority. And I tend to agree with her that the president does not have the legal authority through executive action, through some kind of waiver authority, to forgive student loan debt. Only Congress has the power of the purse. However, there are ways that he could implement loan forgiveness. One would be for Congress to pass a law to create a new loan forgiveness program. The challenge there is very slim margins in the Senate, which means that every Democrat has a veto. And there are some Democrats who are uneasy about forgiving $1 trillion in student loan debt. To forgive $50,000 per borrower would erase the debt of 80% of borrowers and cost over $1 trillion. President Biden, during the campaign, and he's since reaffirmed, he would like to forgive $10,000 per borrower. That would cost over $375 billion. That's still enough to give some policymakers pause. There is an alternative, which is to forgive the student loan debt of just borrowers who owe $10,000 or less. That would still completely erase the student loan debt of a third of borrowers, but cost only $75 billion, which is a drop in the bucket when it comes to the federal budget. The third path to forgiveness is through regulatory action. People often overlook the fact that the income-driven repayment plans are really loan forgiveness programs. They forgive the remaining debt after 20 or 25 years of payments. Well, one of these income-driven repayment plans, the income contingent repayment plan, which is also the first of them, gave the U.S. Department of Education very broad regulatory authority. They can change the number of years until forgiveness occurs. There is a minimum of 5 years, but they could do 5 years. They can change the percentage of discretionary income. I mean, income contingent repayment is 20%, pay-as-you-earn repayment is 10%. They could change that. And they can also change the definition of discretionary income. That's sufficiently broad that they could implement a new loan forgiveness program, allow people to transfer into it, and have their previous payments count towards whatever number of years they decide to require for forgiveness.
What about the issue that has been brought up in the media, in certain political groups, about what do you, if you were to forgive loans, let's say it's whether it's $10,000 or $50,000, what does that say to students who paid back their loans?
There are two sorts of issues that arise. One is financial fairness. The other is moral hazard. So financial fairness says, what about the borrowers who paid back their loans? Don't they get anything? What about people who didn't borrow for college? Or what about people who didn't go to college and therefore don't have student loans to forgive? Is it fair to them to use, quote unquote, their taxpayer dollars to forgive the loans of someone else? And that is a valid point, but we end up with a lot of potential actions by the federal government where one could raise similar issues. Like, I mean, should a pacifist taxpayer dollars go to funding the military? Should someone who doesn't commit crimes have to pay taxes to support the police? And these are a little bit facetious, but the point is that not everything that your taxpayer dollars go to is something that you personally support. And one has to also make the point that people who have college degrees on average pay more than twice the federal income tax of people who have just a high school diploma. So the people who graduated from college are more likely to have their tax dollars paying for the cost of the loan forgiveness. Now, the second issue is one of moral hazard, which is refers to if you know that your student loans are going to be forgiven, you might borrow to the limit more than you should because you're not going to be responsible for repaying that debt. So the question is, if we do forgiveness now, what about the future? What about future students? Are we going to forgive their debt too? Are we going to replace loans with grants in their financial aid packages? These are important policy questions that need to be answered.
I want to get to a book that you wrote, and this relates to the student loans, and it's called Who Graduates from College and Who Doesn't? Obviously, if I go to college, graduate, get a degree, I'm more likely to get a good paying job. If I go to college, but I drop out and I still have loans, maybe I don't get as good a job. So let's talk about that.
So people who drop out of college are four times more likely to default on their student loans than people who graduate. In fact, if we limit it to just people in bachelor degree programs, college dropouts are 95 times more likely to default than college graduates. And the reason is they have the debt, but not the degree that can help them repay the debt. Now, getting back to the original question of loan forgiveness, people are more likely to support loan forgiveness when it's targeted at some sort of financial need or in exchange for service. So public service loan forgiveness forgives you the remaining debt after 10 years worth of payments. That's 120 payments while working full time in a public service job. That includes members of the military, police, fire, EMT, all sorts of nonprofit and government jobs for people who accept a lower salary in exchange for giving back to society. In addition, it includes student loan discharges, such as if you die, your federal student loans are canceled. If you become totally and permanently disabled, your federal student loans are canceled. And so someone who's a quadriplegic is not going to be able to repay their student loans the same as someone who isn't disabled.
So when we look at the dropout rate, is there any explanation why the dropout rate? What causes it? Is it a financial burden? They just simply can't afford the tuition or, room and board of college. What's behind that?
Well, the top reason why people drop out of college is they run out of money. The second most common reason is conflicts between school, home, and work. Someone who works a full-time job while going to college is half as likely to graduate with a bachelor's degree within 6 years as compared with someone who works 12 hours or less a week. People who have families that they need to support are also less likely to graduate from college.
Let's talk about the degrees that students are pursuing. Are, you know, there's certain degrees that you get that really don't lead to a good paying job. Then we know about, you know, the medical profession. We know about technology. We know about engineering, the sciences. Can you talk about what jobs are really in big demand right now? So in other words, if a parent or a student was considering a career, where should that career be directed towards?
So generally speaking, the STEM fields, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, computer science, and healthcare, nursing, for example, pay better and have lower unemployment rates than other academic fields. But more important than the field of study is whether you graduate. Students who drop out of college have the debt, but not the degree that can help them repay the debt. And that's a much more important factor. Even someone who has a degree in underwater basket weaving, if they have that degree, they are much, much less likely to default on their student loans than a student who dropped out.
Is there any kind of financial aid programs or things available for students that are struggling to manage both finances of working and school?
There are financial aid programs. You apply for financial aid from the federal and state governments using the pre-application for federal student aid. And this includes not just loans, but also grants, like the federal Pell Grant, the federal Supplemental Educational Opportunity Grant, and various state grant programs. And two of the largest are the California Cal Grant and the New York TAP Grant for residents of those states. And that makes it easier to pay for college. The challenge, though, is that sometimes the student is the primary wage earner in their family, and they can't afford to not work a full-time job while going to school. Sometimes you have two-parent households where the student avoids working while their spouse works, and then they trade off. But sometimes it's just a single-parent household. And students who are single parents are much less likely to graduate than students who have two parents, or students in a two-parent household, or students who aren't parents at all.
Is there anything out there, you know, we've seen the cost of college education grow by almost 8% a year in terms of cost. As a result of the pandemic, we saw with Zoom and other types of things that a lot of the universities adapted to this. Is there anything out there that is trying to bring the cost of a college education down?
Well, first of all, the Zoomification of education was largely a failure. And when you try to move classes online in a hurry, and you don't design them for an online environment, they're just complete failures. And a lot of students have a lot more difficulty learning in such an online environment. They really do need face-to-face education. Now, and clearly, you could decrease the cost of higher education by increasing class sizes, but then each student gets less FaceTime with that faculty member and with the teaching assistants than if it's a smaller class. There's a lot of evidence that says that smaller class sizes and student-teacher ratios of 6 to 1 to 12 to 1 are much more effective in teaching the students than a class size of 100 to 1. So you do reduce the cost, but you also end up increasing and affecting the quality of education. Now, you could go to a less expensive college. An in-state public college will generally cost a quarter to a third the price of a private college, even after financial aid. So you don't need to go to the most expensive college in your field. I mean, public colleges offer a great quality education, sometimes an even better quality education than the private colleges. You can also economize in college costs besides tuition. You can reduce the cost of textbooks by buying used textbooks or selling them back to the bookstore at the end of the semester. If you're going to college out of state, you could minimize the number of trips home from school. And ultimately, you need to live like a student while you're in school, so you don't have to live like a student after you graduate.
What about the idea, we call it our 2 plus 2 program, where let's say a student goes to a junior college the first 2 years, which are less expensive, and then the final 2 years you go to a state school, which is less expensive than going out of state. I mean, that's what I did. I went to a junior college for 2 years, and then I went on to Arizona State. My degree at Arizona State didn't say, well, half a degree, because I didn't go all 4 years. I got my bachelor's degree from Arizona State. What about a junior college?
Well, you're more the exception to the rule. If you take a detour through a community college on your way to a bachelor's degree, you may miss your destination. You'll certainly save money. But of students who start off at a two-year college intending to obtain a bachelor's degree, only one-fifth, 20%, succeed in getting that bachelor's degree within 6 years. That compares with two-thirds of students who start off at a four-year institution.
So if you were to advise parents right now, let's say you got a family, they got three kids. I mean, if you were to go to an A school for three kids, you know, that could be $250,000 to $300,000 times three. That's almost $1 million. What do you tell a parent with three kids who want to go to school?
Well, first of all, you start saving as soon as possible, and ideally when the child's a newborn. I started saving for my kids' college education before they were born. You try to match the college's net price to your resources. The net price is the difference between the total college costs, which include not just tuition and fees, but also room and board, book supplies and equipment, transportation, and miscellaneous personal expenses. And then you subtract from it the gift aid, the grants and scholarships and other money that doesn't need to be repaid. That's your net price. And that in the, every college has a net price calculator on its website that gives you a personalized estimate of the net price is for just 1 year. So you need to adjust it for all 4 years, or some cases 5 years. And then you compare that with your resources. How much have you saved? How much can you afford to contribute from your current income? And that includes the education tax breaks, like the American Opportunity Tax Credit. And how much debt is reasonable and affordable? You should aim to have your total student loan debt at graduation that is less than your annual starting salary. That then tells you whether or not a college is affordable. If the four-year net price exceeds your available resources, it's not affordable. And so you need to focus on the colleges where you can afford to send your child. I mean, you might want to drive a Lexus, but all you can afford is a Yaris, so you get that Yaris.
So if I was to begin, let's say I'm a parent, I've got a son graduating from high school next month. If I was to begin this process of looking and then also applying for financial aid, take us through what are the steps that you would advise parents?
Okay, so the first step is you craft a college list. You have the child identify the colleges that they're interested in, what possible academic majors they're interested in, make sure the colleges offer those majors. Try to steer them in a less expensive and better financially set of choices. And they may want to go to that really expensive college and major in a field of study that doesn't pay very well. So maybe you get them to consider a less expensive college, and they may not, you shouldn't make them give up their dreams, but maybe have a backup plan. So they want to major in underwater basket weaving. You suggest that they get a second major in something a little bit more practical and lucrative. Then use the net price calculator on each of these college websites to get an idea of what your net price will be so that you can understand whether the college is affordable or not. Then when you apply for admission, you will also submit the free application for federal student aid, or FAFSA form. That's used to apply for need-based financial aid at from the federal government, from the state governments, and most colleges and universities. Less than 200 colleges have a supplemental form that's called the CSS profile form, which is asked twice as many questions and is generally less generous, but it's used by these colleges for calculating their own financial aid funds that you'll be eligible for. They still must use the FAFSA for federal and state aid. You should also look for private scholarships. That can include scholarships based on your academic activities, your hobbies, your sports, your volunteer activities. There are several databases that you can search for free. They include a database from a company called FastWeb. The College Board offers their Big Futures Scholarship Search. There's about a dozen such databases, and they overlap significantly. I suggest searching at least two of them just so that you recognize that there is a lot of overlap. And these will find the scholarships that match your background profile. It's then up to you to apply for these scholarships and hopefully win. I recommend applying to every scholarship for which you're eligible because the odds of you winning any one scholarship are pretty slim. But if you apply to more scholarships, you're more likely to win one.
And a final question, if I may, Mark, if you were to take a look at the top paying jobs that are out there and the jobs that are in greatest demand in the future, what would they be?
Well, computer science is definitely one of them. Every year we hear about how the oil services field, engineering for petroleum engineering, for example, is a high-paying job. But that is not as common as things like computer science, other sciences, mathematics, nursing. Those are the jobs that are more available and that pay better.
All right. Well, I want to mention your books again, especially if you're a parent, you've got a son or daughter graduating next month. How to Appeal for More College Financial Aid is a definite must reading for all. And Mark, you want to give out your website? You've got a couple of websites, but ones that would deal directly with college funding.
And so I don't have a current website per se. I write for thecollegeinvestor.com. I have a website about private student loans called privatestudentloans.guru, which is the only website about private student loans that says don't borrow them. For people who are interested in student aid policy and public policy analyses, I have a website called studentaidpolicy.com, which has links to all of the public policy papers that I've written, including several that have generated the rules of thumb, like live like a student while you're in school so you don't have to live like a student after you graduate, and total debt at graduation should be less than annual income. But it's a much more technical website.
Well, you've done a great service to, I think, a lot of students and parents, and I want to thank you for joining us on the program, and I wish you all the best, sir.
The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Please be advised that you invest at your own risk.